Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
We're building that wall. We're building the wall. Don't worry. We've already started.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And on Saturday evening, President Trump held a rally in Delaware, Ohio.
Instead of apologizing for America, we are standing up for America. We are standing up for the heroes who protect our country. Maxine, she's a real beauty. Maxine, a seriously low IQ person. A vote for Danny Boy and the Democrats is a vote to let criminals and drugs pour into our country and to let MS-13 run wild in our communities. And you know what they do once they're there. And we are proudly standing up for our national anthem. Thank you.
Trump was at Olentangy Orange High School to support Troy Balderson, a Republican state Senate candidate for the 12th district. But that's not what he focused on.
The Democrats are obstructionists. They are haters. They have tremendous hatred.
And some of what the president said was very upsetting.
In the sanctuary state of California, Air Force veteran Marilyn Ferris was viciously raped, murdered, and beaten to death with a hammer by an illegal alien with a long criminal history. Should have never been in our country.
This rally came 2 days after a rally in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and it followed another rally in Tampa, Florida, where, as usual, aggressive crowds heckled reporters while the president egged them on. The president's rallies are nothing new. Since November 2016, the president has held more than 24 rallies, many of them connected to 2018 midterm contests. But these rallies aren't merely political stunts. There's something darker going on here.
He actually has some impressive gut intuitions about how to activate collective emotions in his followers, especially moral emotions around anger and disgust. He's skilled at identifying common enemies and scapegoats and using those to rally the people in the audience who are there to support him.
This is something actually that has gone on in American history for 150 years, this desire of voters to attend rallies with national leaders and hear a sort of emotional speech.
Jeremy Young is an associate professor of history at Dixie State University and author of The Age of Charisma, Leaders, Followers, and Emotions in American Society, 1870 through 1940. I sat down with him and Jay Van Bavel, associate professor of psychology at New York University.
So what he's trying to do is build a common identity with these individuals and around his causes. And then what they're hoping to do usually is mobilize people. So mobilize them to vote in primary elections or general elections to get them to volunteer, donate money. Many of these people will feel energized after. This is common in political rallies. Now, by broadcasting these in the mainstream media, he's able to impact people around the country who are sitting at home as well. So he seems to be able to amplify his message very powerfully with these types of organized rallies.
And I'm wondering why Americans, and I'll pose this questions to both of you, why is it that this segment of the population, because these rallies are not attended by everybody, they're very much Trump's base, if you will, why this segment of the population is so whipped into a frenzy by largely what I would call hate messaging?
I think here Jay's point about the hate and the anger and disgust that is being whipped up at these rallies is very important, because while certainly there have been political rallies with emotional content in American history for a long time, it's been pretty rare that they have been so focused on othering people, on finding groups to blame things on, to create as scapegoats. And that is one of the things that we have to be careful of here, I think, is to identify the difference between a charismatic political rally used for good and a charismatic political rally that is used in dangerous ways. And the line between fascism and Martin Luther King is very slim in some ways. And one of the key differences is that someone like King, who uses this tool for good, is focusing on an uplifting message, focusing on some kind of concrete positive change, whereas someone like Trump is focusing on blaming problems on certain groups and whipping his followers into a frenzy about them.
And Jeremy, you had I want to go through a bunch of examples, but Jay, I'd love to hear your response to why hate is so effective in this environment.
Yeah, that's a great question. And we've been analyzing Trump's language on Twitter, which is the other way that he gets his message out to people and creates a connection with him. And what we've found is that, first of all, among almost anybody, myself, yourself, Jeremy, is people who use moral emotional language like disgust, anger, or hate in their Twitter messages are more likely to have those messages go viral. So every single kind of moral emotional word increases the likelihood it's going to be a message will be shared or retweeted, you know, by 15 to 20%. When we analyzed Trump, he was off the charts. Not only does he use that language a lot, but when he uses it, it radically amplifies his message on Twitter. It's far more likely to go viral. Now, what we've also found is that when it goes viral, it only goes viral within echo chambers. So it's only among people who share your ideology on the left or right who tend to amplify those kind of tribal messages. And so he's basically using this language through multiple mediums, and it spreads. And it creates a sense of contagion, I think, of the emotion among the people who are hearing it, especially in a rally where you're surrounded by others and there's yelling and people are getting quite animated. But it tends to only work on people who are already committed to your cause. Now, to contrast it with somebody like Martin Luther King, what he was trying to send out was a universal message about universal values and principles and goals as a country, rather than just rally a subset of people who were supporting him. And so that is also consistent with what Jeremy was saying, is that one type of language tends to stay within your tiny group, and the other type of language is designed to draw in the broadest possible audience to support some kind of broader principle.
So I want to talk about some historical precedent. We've already talked about Martin Luther King as an example of sort of positive emotional rhetoric. There are a couple of other examples I want to get into there. But let's talk about some historical examples that are more in line with, you know, similar strategies to what the current president is using. And Jeremy, you suggested one example was, unfortunately, Adolf Hitler.
Absolutely. And I'm not the first historian to make that comparison either.
Musstet als Partei in der Minorität bleiben, weil wir die wertvollsten Elemente des Kampfes.
Hitler hammered away at what he called die Dolchstoß, the stab in the back, which was the idea that the political leaders of Germany in World War I, influenced in some nebulous way by Jews, had capitulated to the European powers and destroyed Germany. And these people were dead or out of power, and Hitler nevertheless went after them, hammer and tongs, and blamed them for everything that was going wrong in the state, even though it didn't really have anything to do with them.
And you also mentioned a speech by Huey Long from 1935 called Share the Wealth. Tell us about that.
Huey Long was a very interesting figure in American history. He was the governor of Louisiana, nominally a Democrat, but waged a sort of third-party attack on Franklin Roosevelt during the early years of the New Deal, arguing that Roosevelt, on the one hand, wasn't redistributing wealth enough, and on the other hand, wasn't taking enough power away from corporations. So in some ways, Long was a sort of left-wing fascist, if you will.
And over 70% of the people of America don't own enough to pay the debts that they owe. How many men ever went to a barbecue and would let one man take off the table what's intended for 9/10 of the people to eat?
This speech is very interesting because of the way that Long draws on this type of angry emotional rhetoric to motivate followers to respond to it.
Jeremy, I'm wondering also, there are times when this hasn't happened, when political rhetoric has been used, as we mentioned with Martin Luther King more broadly. You also have a historical example of Ronald Reagan in a speech that he gave called A Time for Choosing. Tell us about that.
So Reagan's speech is in some ways, it's the first speech that made Reagan a national political figure. It was the speech he gave at the 1964 Republican National Convention nominating Barry Goldwater for president. And it was really an extraordinary speech in which Reagan took the ideas of conservatism and distilled them into something that really made sense to people at an emotional level.
If you and I have the courage to tell our elected officials that we want our national policy based on what we know in our hearts is morally right, We cannot buy our security, our freedom from the threat of the bomb, by committing an immorality so great as saying to a billion human beings now enslaved behind the Iron Curtain, give up your dreams of freedom, because to save our own skins, we're willing to make a deal with your slave masters.
And I think it's important here to keep in mind that people's desire to connect emotionally with their leaders isn't necessarily wrong. This is something that is that may be hardwired into human nature somehow. We see this 150 years ago, and just as much as we see it today. And in fact, the idea that people will follow emotional speakers regardless of the facts is also an old idea. I was reading a speech recently from 1896 by a senator who was opposed to imperialism in America, and he attacks his opponents for engaging in what he calls false news. So this idea is not new. What is important here, I think, is that we can't cede the ground of emotion to people who want to use it for dangerous purposes. I think people all across the political spectrum are looking for this kind of emotional connection, and we need to be able to provide it for them. If we're concerned about the way it's being provided for them, we need to be able to provide it for them in a healthier way.
I'll just build on what Jeremy was saying. And so in psychology, there's a term called identity leadership. And I'll just tell you briefly, there was a study of political leaders running for office in Australia over many, many years. And they find that leaders who use collective pronouns like we, us, them, which is the other, are more likely to be elected than those who don't. And so that's an effective strategy for getting elected and rallying people and making them feel a connection with you. And so Trump is doing that. And I agree with Jeremy. What you need to do is realize that you don't want to cede that ground, that you just need an alternative vision of identity and someone who is good at making the case. And what I would say is that your identity needs to be broader. It needs to be around principles that are more encompassing of all citizens and can be more appealing to a wider segment of society. And so if you look at Trump's approval ratings, they've been pretty much stuck at 40% plus or minus 2 points for his entire presidency. What that means is there's a huge opportunity for somebody else with a broader message who can appeal to 60% of people. And so I think that, you know, instead of trying to appeal to a segment of society who's probably not going to move at all in terms of their opinions, try to encapsulate a broader segment of society under similar messages that can make them feel identified in a common sense of purpose and mobilize them to make positive change. So in that sense, I think there's a big opening for change in the coming elections.
Well, we'll see what happens with midterms right around the corner. That's Jay Van Bavel, Associate Professor of Psychology at New York University, and Jeremy Young, Assistant Professor of History at Dixie State University. Thank you both so much for your insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The trial of Donald Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, is about to enter its second week. Manafort faces charges of tax fraud and bank fraud, financial crimes related to the more than $60 million he made while working as a political consultant for former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych. If convicted, he could face decades in jail. In Alexandria, Virginia, where Manafort's trial is taking place, federal prosecutors are moving quickly through their list of 35 witnesses. Here to bring us up to speed on the latest developments is Andrea Bernstein, senior editor for WNYC and host of the Trump Bing podcast. Andrea, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, great to be here.
So we need an update on what's been happening. The prosecution has said they expect to wrap up their case by the end of the week.
That is what they said last week. So initially, they had said it was going to be a 3-week trial. It may just be a 2-week trial. The judge is bearing down on them. He keeps interrupting. He keeps telling them to move along. At times, he takes over the questioning. And they are clearly trying to go along with his set of rules and move rapidly through their set of witnesses.
So we're still waiting to hear from Rick Gates.
Actually, we just got news that Rick Gates is testifying this afternoon. And it's a big deal. Rick Gates has very important testimony. He has pleaded guilty. He is cooperating with the special counsel's office. He was Trump's deputy campaign manager and Paul Manafort's longtime business partner. And he seems to know almost everything that went on in his company. So his testimony could be, on the one hand, damaging to Paul Manafort because he knows so much, and also the defense is trying to pin its hopes on Rick Gates, too, by saying that actually the whole scheme was Rick Gates's idea. So we're waiting to hear from the Rick Gates testimony. But what we do know is that there have been waves of evidence in this trial.
The first wave was these ostrich suits.
Yes, and the jackets and the very expensive
pergola, yeah. And the M made out of roses that cost $450,000. There were all these lavish things that people spent money on. And the judge kept saying, it's not a crime to be rich. And what the prosecution is saying, we're not saying it's a crime to be rich. We're saying it's a crime to pay for these directly with international wire transfers from Cyprus, which is what he was doing. And it was very interesting because there was one high-end clothier from Fifth Avenue, the one who sold him his ostrich suits and about $1 million worth of clothing over a period of about 4 years. And he was said, well, I mean, aren't your clients wealthy? And he said, yes, they're wealthy. And then he was asked, well, have you had other clients pay by international wire transfer? And he said, no, Paul Manafort was the only one. So the theory the prosecution is laying out is that he got this money from Viktor Yanukovych, this Ukrainian strongman who is sort of a Russian-leaning, although that part hasn't really come up in the trial, and that he was paid secretly by Ukrainian oligarchs through shell companies, and that to avoid taxes and to not tell the IRS, he was paying all these vendors directly. So there was that. And then there was a series of accountants and bookkeepers, and we're still in the middle of that. And some of them have use immunity, which means they can't be prosecuted. So on Friday, the end of the day, there was some dramatic testimony about how Manafort was lying. She knew that he was filling out improper tax forms. She regretted going along with it, but he had been a longtime great client. And so she says she felt obliged.
So, Andrea, what about the president's campaign? Has that come up at all so far?
Well, so far, the name Trump has only come up in the context of Trump Tower, which was one of the places where some of these repairs had been made that were funded by international wire transfer. But not so much the Trump campaign. The defense, in cross-examining one of the witnesses, pointed out that this witness was a Democrat who had worked with Manafort in Ukraine. But this is not a case about the Trump campaign, except one thing we're still expecting, and this testimony could come any day now, which is that there was a banker, Steve Koch, from Chicago, who wanted to get a job in the Trump administration. And the prosecution's theory that they've said in pretrial hearings they're going to lay out is that he gave Paul Manafort a big bank loan that he didn't deserve in the hopes of getting a high-level job, perhaps Secretary of the Army. So we haven't seen that testimony yet, and the jurors really haven't heard about it. This trial is really about tax fraud and bank fraud. And even though the prosecution is really getting ridden by this judge, they're laying out very methodically the evidence that they have.
This is also the first case to go to trial that's resulted from charges brought by Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. And I guess the question is, are we getting a sense of how Mueller's team will operate as more of their cases make it to the courtroom?
Well, in the sense that they are not getting caught up in intrigue, they seem to be very straightforward. I think what we know is that we don't know until they tell us what they're going to do. And they're very straightforward. I mean, they said, we're not going to get into the Russia collusion in this trial. It's not part of this case. And they didn't in their opening arguments, and it hasn't come in through any of their witnesses. Now, having said that, Paul Manafort has another trial in Washington, D.C., which is for money laundering and conspiracy against the United States. So if that case goes to trial, some of this could begin to come in. But obviously, the Mueller investigation continues to be very active on several fronts. And, you know, we find out that there's an indictment when we get a press release in our inbox, and it can come at any moment.
And so Manafort is not done after this trial, correct?
He is not done. He's facing the second trial in the District of Columbia, which is for the same actions but different crimes. And he chose this. He chose to have two trials, one in Virginia, one in the District of Columbia. So this one is sort of narrowly focused on these financial crimes.
And so we're heading into another week of testimony?
Right. And we expect to hear from his former business partner, Rick Gates. The whole thing could hinge on him, whether the jury believes what he says about Paul Manafort or they think he is still lying to save his own skin, which is, of course,
what the danger of a cooperating witness is.
Andrea Bernstein is senior editor for WNYC and host of the Trump Inc. podcast. Andrea, thank you as always.
Thank you. And we have a special episode on this up right now of Trump Inc.
A few weeks ago, you might remember we spoke to a couple of very spirited grandmothers, including Michelle Clifton.
We are grannies on a mission.
Michelle is one of the hundreds of grandmothers that make up a nationwide movement called Grannies Respond, Abuelas Responden. And they've organized a caravan from New York to the U.S.-Mexico border with rallies planned at stops along the way.
We're going to shout out for freedom now.
And Michelle has been documenting the trip for us.
And give them safety at last.
Okay, and we're riding on the bus, and we're on the way from New York City to Reading, Pennsylvania. We missed our exit, so we're having to go back. And but I have to say, this has been such a wonderful experience. I have a really strong feeling that I have to go on this trip. And we've gotten over 200 emails of people who want to join the caravan. So who knows what city they're going to hook up with us, or if they're going to come in their own vehicles, or whatever, but so exciting. We'll see how many meet us at McAllen.
When we sing for human rights, oh, when we sing for human rights, oh, how I want to be in that number.
Michelle Clifton here. It's 5:30 in the morning, and I'm just waking up in Reading, Pennsylvania. You know, yesterday was so wonderful. I don't know if you can hear, but it's raining outside right now, and there's people so wonderful to welcome me into their home, and they have this 7-year-old daughter who's just great, and she was saying that she imagined a person that could not walk that much and would be kind of feeble. And I think she was surprised to see that I'm so able-bodied and, you know, so much fun.
Silent! We will not be silent! We will not be silent! We will not be silent.
Woo!
Yay!
Harrisburg, Grannies Respond, Abuelas Respondon has arrived in your city.
Woo!
Remember this day. You are witnessing a rebellion of grandmothers, the heart and soul of family itself. This group is traveling from New York and from Portland, Oregon, and Madison, Wisconsin, and Tallahassee, Florida, and Atlanta, Georgia. They're stopping in Pittsburgh, Louisville, Montgomery, Alabama, New Orleans, and Houston on their way to McAllen, Texas, protesting the treatment of immigrant families.
Immigrants now, build this land, let my people stay. Hear our voices, we demand, let my people stay.
The thing that was so moving to me is so many people came up to me and said, thank you for going. Thank you for going to the border. And I feel like that's what I'm doing. I'm representing people across this country. And I'm bringing hope. And I'm doing, I mean, I'm doing this for me. I had to do this. I just had to take a stand.
Free to be with family, let my people say.
Big thanks to Granny Michelle Clifton for documenting this journey for us. And you can see some of her photos of the trip at thetakeaway.org. The Granny Caravan arrived in Texas over the weekend.
Brought to our shore, let my people say. Hatred and bigotry.
All alone in these streets, cousin. Every man for himself in his land. We be gunning and keep them shook crews running like they supposed to. They come around, but they never come close to.
That's Shook Ones Part 2, probably one of the most famous tracks by the legendary 90s hip-hop duo Mobb Deep. The song was on their second album, The Infamous, which propelled Mobb Deep from being a relatively unknown hip-hop duo to a commercial success.
Your simple words just don't move me. You're minor, we major. You're all up in the game and don't deserve to be a player.
But what influenced their music? Part of it was the personal struggle of Prodigy, one of Mobb Deep's founding members.
My life before hip-hop was just pain, like, sickle cell was my life before hip-hop. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I ain't really have no life. That was it. You know, I'm growing up, and just that's all I knew was just being in a hospital all the time.
That was Prodigy talking in 2013 about his struggles with sickle cell anemia. Last year, Prodigy died. But a new podcast called The Realness from WNYC explores the complexities of sickle cell anemia through Prodigy's story. Christopher Johnson is co-host of The Realness and a reporter and producer with the health unit here at WNYC. I spoke to him about the life and death of Prodigy and why we're finally starting to learn about a disease that for decades was largely misunderstood.
His mother found him in a closet when he was about 12 years old with a steak knife and I think a noose he also had in the closet, hiding, thinking about or planning to kill himself. This disease was so painful. It was killing him so much inside that he's just like, I would rather die. And then, thank goodness, of course, for him and his family and also for us as hip-hop fans, he found rap music shortly after that. It, in many ways, saved his life.
And then music, when I first started hearing like Run DMC, you know, the aggressiveness of it, it just attracted me to hip-hop. Because I was angry inside. I was an angry kid because of the sickle cell. And So I like the anger in hip-hop. That's what made me want to do it. It helped me get my aggression out.
Why did you think it was important to focus on this particular health issue through Prodigy's story?
For us, it made sense to kind of say, let's tell a kind of biopic story about this guy and merge it with our telling of sickle cell and use Prodigy, although he was a celebrity and he was successful and he had access to resources that many of us don't have. He still ran up against a lot of the barriers in disparities in care and discrimination that people who aren't celebrities, who aren't wealthy, run up against when they have sickle cell. So he was a good example of a person who experienced sickle cell, but also was a really compelling figure because of his life independent of sickle cell or outside of his life with sickle cell.
And talking about sickle cell, because I feel like some people think of it, they've heard of the disease, but it's not something that's front of mind for a lot of folks. What can you tell us broadly about who this disease impacts most and what it feels like? What are the outcomes of someone with sickle cell?
Yeah. In the United States, it is known as, quote unquote, a black disease. It primarily impacts people of African descent. That's about 2 million people in the United States have the sickle cell trait. And about 100,000 people have sickle cell anemia, which is the worst, sort of the worst form of sickle cell. It's the kind Prodigy had. It's where you're red blood cells sickle and they get kind of basically blocked in your veins and your arteries, which sort of prohibits the flow of oxygen. It can be excruciating. We have tape of Prodigy talking about all these different stories of experiencing unbelievable pain, like his bones are burning is the way he's described it. It can really, really take you out and it can like occur anywhere in the body. And also like there are people who have it for sure, sickle cell anemia, who don't experience it necessarily as painfully as Prodigy did. Because it's also important to remember that when Prodigy was becoming successful, he was also living like a rock star. When Mobb Deep started to really become successful in the mid-90s, they were traveling a lot, of course, and going all over the world. And Prodigy has these sort of infinite number of stories about how they would land, say, in Paris or in in New Delhi, and he would immediately have to go to the hospital because flying can aggravate sickle cell. He'd have to go to the hospital. They'd have to cancel shows. His partner Havoc would have to go on by himself. Those kinds of things were really kind of really affecting the music in a way that I certainly didn't know.
When Prodigy was diagnosed with sickle cell, what did we know about the disease then, and how has that evolved to where we are today?
So Prodigy was diagnosed in 75. He was about 5 months old. This was just a few years after what was called the Sickle Cell Anemia Control Act was passed. This was in 1972 in the Nixon administration. This disease had been diagnosed about, 50 years earlier, 50 or 60 years earlier, had been sort of identified. But just in the few years before he's born, there's a major shift in care for two main reasons. One, it's the Sickle Cell Control Act, but it's also because just about, a couple decades earlier, penicillin antibiotics get introduced into the United States. But then things get interesting because they're living longer, but there's no real infrastructure to take care of teenagers and then adults and then older men and women who have the disease. That's kind of being built as they're getting older. A lot of people live with the disease, right? And so the main treatment tends to be pain management. And so it's often kind of opioids and the like. And for Prodigy, that was primarily what he was taking from the time that he was a child.
And you mentioned this earlier about the treatment that he was able to get, but also the obstacles that he faced in getting some of that treatment. And I want to play a clip from him talking about that briefly.
Well, I think it also has to do with race sometimes. If a black person is coming in asking for pain medicine, they identify that with drug abuse, like a drug addict. You know what I mean? I've had terrible emergency room experiences when I was a little kid. Like, they would lock me in the back room and threaten to call the cops if I ain't shut up, like stuff like that.
So, Christopher, that's pretty awful. And we know that these health disparities continue today. What can you tell us about his experience, Prodigy's experience, in trying to get adequate treatment for this sickle cell?
His experience, and I also interviewed his brother, who's 13 years older, and his brother also described taking Prodigy, he wasn't Prodigy back then, but taking him to the hospital and seeing medical staff not quite know what to do, or not when he's older and he's an older black man covered in tattoos, right? Who's been treated a certain way at that point for 20 years, 20 some odd years, and not just by the healthcare system, but by America, right? He walks into a hospital or to an ER, and yeah, he might be a little bit aggressive. And so his experience often, it was rough. And it's important to kind of keep that in mind, because again, we're talking about a guy who people know who he is. They know that he's a celebrity. He was a big deal in the 90s. So this is a guy who has access, he has resources, he has connections, and still he's going through having to fight for what he deserves, which is good medical care.
Fascinating stuff. That was Christopher Johnson, co-host of the new podcast called The Realness here at WNYC. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
It's been nearly a year since Charlottesville, Virginia became another symbol for the growing visibility of white supremacy in the United States. That was after the largest gathering of white nationalists in decades converged upon the city to protest the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee. Local authorities failed to prevent violent clashes between white nationalists and counter-protesters. Protester Heather Heyer was killed when a man drove his car through a crowded street. Two state troopers died in a helicopter crash, and dozens more were injured. But the president refused to take sides.
I think there's blame on both sides. What about the alt-left that came charging at the, as you say, the alt-right? Do they have any semblance of guilt? I've condemned many different groups, but not all of those people were neo-Nazis, believe me.
A.C. Thompson is a reporter with ProPublica and a correspondent for Frontline, and he covered the rally and has continued to report on its fallout for the last year. His findings are detailed in a new documentary out this week from ProPublica and PBS Frontline, and it's called Documenting Hate, Charlottesville. And he joins me now to discuss it. A.C., thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
So really tough stuff to talk about. When I was watching this, I kept thinking state and local authorities just felt really underprepared for what happened in Charlottesville. But they also appeared to be somewhat disinterested in preventing violence. Can you help me understand what happened?
Yeah, it's a really important issue. So there's a 200-page report that looks into what happened that day. It's called the Hafey Report. It was commissioned by the city of Charlottesville. And basically what it says is, there was a lack of preparation. There was a lack of communication. The state police were there with 600 officers. The local police had about 130 officers, and they couldn't talk to each other on radios. They didn't have each other's operational plans. There were a lot of breakdowns like that. But I think the most important thing to understand is that there was what appears to have been basically a conscious decision on the part of Charlottesville police to allow violence to occur in the streets and let that violence happen and then declare an unlawful assembly and say, hey, we're going to clear everyone out. And that violence absolutely spiraled out of control. And I think we can say clearly a year later, that was a really, really bad decision.
Well, and I also want to think, I mean, I've covered events in after the events of Michael Brown and Ferguson, for example, when you have the potential for largely black and brown protesters coming out, the police seem to have pretty severe measures put in place to handle that. So I was thinking, as I'm watching this, I couldn't imagine if it was a group of black nationalists, for example, the police would have a similar response. In fact, there were some clips in the documentary that people are actually asking police to intervene, and they choose not to.
Right. I think what was remarkable is that we had had almost 2 years of clashes at white supremacist and Klan rallies all across the country. In Anaheim, we had 3 people stabbed. In Sacramento, we had 7 people stabbed. In Berkeley, we had hours and hours of brutal violence out in the streets. This is political violence. And the police were on alert that you could have really bad outcomes in these circumstances. And yet in Charlottesville, they let that pattern of sort of mutual combat persist. And I think you're right. I think when we've seen protests involving Black Lives Matter, when we've seen other protests, we had seen much more aggressive interventionist policing. And that time period from the middle of early 2016 through August 2017, I think you saw this sort of really, really poorly thought out laissez-faire, let them just fight it out policing.
So, to me, when we see how easily it is that Black and Brown Americans lose their lives in this country, I find it almost impossible that the cops, whether it's federal authorities, state authorities, local authorities, just can't seem to get it together to have better protections in place when it's white supremacists and nationalists who are showing up.
What's particularly worrisome about Charlottesville is they had preparation in their own town. They had a white power rally with Richard Spencer a few months earlier. Then they had a Klan rally. And then they had Unite the Right in August 2017. So both nationally, they could look at the picture of what was happening, but also locally, they could see it in their town. And then when you go back to the independent report on what happened, there is testimony in there that the police chief, Al Thomas at the time, he has since retired, said, hey, we're going to let them fight it out. It'll make it easier to clear them out later. We're just going to let them fight it out. He denied that later. But everything that you can see from the evidence that's been collected is that that was basically the policy.
Now, we're talking about last year's Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. And with reporter A.C. Thompson here. A.C., I'm wondering, we saw reports about a week ago of a Unite the Right rally or Identity Europa, one of these white supremacists here in New York City, in Fort Tryon Park. Did the events in Charlottesville, in your estimation, sort of signal that this type of protest is okay? I mean, have these groups become emboldened as a result of what happened in Charlottesville?
No, I actually think things are different than that. I think what's happened is the movement has gone in 3 different directions. So what you saw here in New York is you saw Identity Europa doing what they do now, which is sort of flash mob type activism. We're going to drop a banner. We're going to show up somewhere quickly. We're going to put out posters, but we're not going to tell you where we're going to be ahead of time. It's much more a hit and run. You've seen people drop out of the movement. That's another consequence of what happened in Charlottesville. Some people said, it's too much for me. I went out. And a third group of people has said, you know, what I really want to do is kill folks. I mean, honestly, that's what they've said. And they've gone in the terrorist direction. They've said, I'm going to pursue a lone wolf strategy of fighting back against the government. And that's my plan now.
And so are you seeing any way for any of these responses? Like how does the media respond? How should law enforcement respond to these three groups that you're talking about? Because when it's somebody who says, I'm going to be a lone wolf and go off and kill people, I mean, that's terrible.
Yeah, it's terrifying. But at the same time I say it's terrifying, I also think people should be, they should be alert, they should be concerned, but they shouldn't be paranoid and overwhelmed. So when we look at groups like we reported on in our film, a group called Atomwaffen, that's a neo-Nazi group that explicitly says, we want to overthrow the government and start a race war. We want to engage in political terrorism.
And are they growing, AC?
We believe that after Charlottesville, their numbers grew. I think recently they've had some setbacks and are probably a little bit smaller, but yeah, they grew. You look at them and you say, they're important to keep an eye on. They're explicitly aimed at political violence on a large scale, but there are also not that many of them. And so we don't want to be terrified, but we want to be alert.
Now, we're a year after Charlottesville at the end of this week. Where are we today? You've been following these groups since then. Where are we, in a better position or a worse position than we were a year ago?
I think the worrisome thing is that the ideology has seeped further and further into the mainstream. And I think that's the worrying thing. I think the groups are somewhat fractured, somewhat fragmented, and maybe not as active as they were. But I think they've already been successful at a certain level.
And that's something that I think a lot of us, both in the media and beyond, need to be worried about. I mean, this is serious rhetoric that's actually having consequences.
Exactly. Exactly.
A.C. Thompson is a reporter for ProPublica and Frontline, which is produced by our partners at WGBH. And the Frontline and ProPublica joint investigation called Documenting Hate in Charlottesville premieres Tuesday night on PBS stations and on their website. A.C., thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow, we're going to continue our coverage of white supremacist groups in the United States, this time by taking a look back in time. In 1978, Ron Stallworth was the only black officer in the Colorado Springs Police Department, and he decided to infiltrate a local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan by calling them up on the phone.
I had to convince them through my voice, through my words, through the inflection of tone that I projected those words, I had to convince them that I was one of them.
Spike Lee's new movie, Black Klansman, tells Ron's story, and it opens this Friday. Ahead of the release, I sat down with the real Ron Stallworth and John David Washington, who plays Ron on screen.
Ron was speaking the language of hate to infiltrate it. You know, so there was like, just like you speak Spanish, you speak French, where, you know, you had to be able to speak hate to be able to get in with these guys, and he was able to.
You can catch more of my conversation with Ron Stallworth and John David Washington on our show tomorrow. Until then, thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.